So I think all of our governors are in a contest to find out who is the most ridiculous. And we think California's winning that race. But and I want to say, give our greetings to all of you from Steve and Becky. And Stu and Debbie was already mentioned. They're unable to make it, but they love being here with all of you also. So California really is a crazy place, and it's getting crazier. we just found out a few months ago that Celebration Church, where we're at, holds the distinction of being attacked by more state government agencies than any church in the state. So they've come after us from several levels. It's a long story how we got where we are, but in mid-January, the Director of Health and Human Services in the state of California filed a lawsuit against me, against the church, and against Grace International with up to 19 people to be named later. So I gave them Craig and Eddie's phone number so that they could be... You guys have no excitement. We'll bring you to California and have excitement.
We don't want to do this by ourselves.
The court case was set for St. Patrick's Day, the 17th, but our legal team, our legal representation, have already answered the complaint. There were about six areas. Three of them were economical. We had $100 a day fines levied against the church because I personally stood up when the regulations were that every child had to be masked while they were indoors. We had a preschool open 11 hours a day, and the age went to 2 years of age, so the state demanded that we make two-year-olds wear a mask for 11 hours straight.
And it was during all the fires
that
were down there, so it was just ridiculous.
So I said it was child abuse. They didn't like me, and so one government agency, we had our license taken away, which the church lost immediately, $17,000 a month in income. And then one agency after the other, OSHA, everybody. So that's where we are. We're waiting for the courts to hear back from the judge. Our side, our appeal to the accusations made by the state, that'll be heard by a judge. And if it's not in our favor, our legal team, Advocates for Faith and Freedom, they've actually argued a couple of the cases in California that the church sued the state to the Supreme Court. So these guys are sharp. And if we don't win, we'll litigate and continue to litigate. If it needs to be, the appeal will be made to the Supreme Court. And here's why. It went from us refusing to make kids wear masks. They took the license away. We said, okay, have it. Then they wanted us to get it back. I said, I don't want it. I don't want you to tell us anything to do. So we opened up children's ministry Monday through Friday. Really did. And we completely rewrote every bit of documentation to say we did not have a preschool, we did not have a daycare. We have children's ministry. Even the titles, we don't take tuition, people make contributions. But seriously, it was very creative. And so they have nothing to say that we are illegally running a preschool or a daycare. There's just nothing there. They have to prove their case. Here's the importance of it. And I'm only saying this, honestly, when you get to a certain age, you look for something that gets you excited. And this is excitement for me. It really is, man. I'm up for the fight. And we really are. We are up for the fight. And the importance of it, because it moved from a mask mandate to the state wanting to control how a church ministers, when it ministers, and to whom it ministers. That's what's at stake. And if this case is lost, if it goes as far as the SCOTUS, if it's lost, it will open the door for the state of California and then every state to control anything that a church does. That's where it goes. And it's against the Free Exercise Clause, the very First Amendment of our Constitution. So, just keep praying, and we believe we're going to have victory. We really do. And our churches, and they're excited for the fight, too. So we've already run off all the liberals. But is this recorded, too? No, that's nice. We're really glad. So today, here's what we want to talk about. We want to talk about managing marriage in a hostile environment. And here's why. Because you in ministry... Your marriage and your family is always going to be under attack. Always. And I don't think we're captured with the significance of that enough. And so we've not been the best parents. I'm glad my kids aren't here to say amen. But, you know, we blew it. We really did. Our kids walked through some really hard seasons. You know, when they're young, you threaten that you're going to kill them. I actually wanted to when they got older. I mean, just had made some really dumb mistakes. And so we took that personally. Some of you know, I don't have to shake your head, but I'm going to assume that when your kids didn't do the things you thought they should do, the enemy told you, you are disqualified for your call. Who do you think you are? You messed up. Well, yeah, I messed up. And the only problem with Proverbs 22:6, train a child in the way he should go, and when he was old, he will not depart. I'm going to tell you, the only rub of that scripture is the Bible doesn't say the span of time from train them and when they're old. We don't know how long that is. For some of them, it's one wild party, scares them to death, and they come to Jesus. For some of them, they're in their 40s and still running hard. So ours isn't today to condemn. I found it fascinating that it was observed how many young families and kids and parents who are here. So we're going to share a little bit, and I want to give a little more introduction to our topic from the text that we're going to read. And then we want to give you three things that we targeted in our life and ministry. Three things that really were important for us as far as our marriage and as far as raising our kids. And we're going to tell you why I think that is so important. So if you want to, Ephesians chapter 5, we're going to read, starting at verse number 22. And when I chose this text, my wife says, well, of course, you're going to talk about wives submitting to their husbands. I said, I think that's the conviction of the Holy Spirit, but we'll go on from there. So
no comment at the moment.
Ephesians 5, beginning to verse 22.
Wives, submit yourselves to your own husbands as you do to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife as Christ is the head of the church, his body of which he is the Savior. Now as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church, without a stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. In this same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, no one ever hated their own body, but they feed and care for their body, just as Christ does the church. For we are members of his body. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, but I am talking about Christ and the church. However, each one of you also must love his wife as he loves himself, and the wife must respect her husband.
I'm going to assume that we have delicately taught this in our churches. And if you're wise, it's best to have your wife talk about the submission part because it's easier for her to address women. We honestly don't do that. I think the Bible is applicable to anybody in any situation by whatever messenger God sends. But we've talked about this kind of stuff. And we're not going to go through all of that because I want to draw your attentions particularly to verse 31. I want to spend a little time discovering where that came from and what it means and then applying it to the relationship that we're supposed to have as husband and wife. It says, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother, be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. You'll notice that's in quotation marks. That's actually a quote from the book of beginnings, the book of Genesis, Genesis chapter 2. And here's the sequence of those events. Remember, God made man and all the animals and all this stuff, and everybody had a partner but man. And so God says, it's not good for man to be alone. You know, I'm going to make someone who is sufficient to help him. Now, If you knew all the comedic things that come to my mind when I'm talking and how much I don't say, you would be very proud. I just find so much humor and stuff in the Bible. And I found this to be humorous. Okay, Adam, now we know the 6 days of creation, and there's a theology discussion. Was that 6 1,000-year periods? Was it actually 6 24-hour periods? How long did it all take place? After all, it's all done. Adam's by himself, having a good time, all the animals. It's a wonderful life. He has nobody. God puts him to sleep, takes a rib, and forms this creation. You know, what's fascinating is how God placed in his mind who she was. Because he wakes up. Now, he wakes up, here's what he says. You know, that's flesh of my flesh, bone of my bone. And then this quote, for this reason a man will leave it. You know how I see that? How long was this guy running around the garden by himself? Now, of all the beauty of all of the women and all of you in the whole world, can you imagine how ravishing Eve was? I think that poor lonely wanderer woke up and he sees her, and God says, Adam, let me tell you. He goes, oh no, God, I've got this. I think he would have right away known what needed to happen. As beautiful as she was. I'm sorry. As beautiful as she was.
I got nothing.
But then right after Paul mentions this, he says it's a great mystery, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. And here's the parallel I want to draw. We forget that we have been invited into a relationship with one who has done everything to prove his love for us, and one to whom we respond with absolute submission. And we are one with Christ. The Bible says that. It's inseparable. And we do all that we can to make sure our relationship with Christ is strong. And we teach people to do the same. And we know the target of the enemy is to do what he can to separate Christ from those who are one with him. That's the struggle of humanity. The temptations of humanity is to make a separation between Christ and the church. But we forget that that is nothing more than a parallel of a husband and wife. Because we are one. Alfred Edersheim, if you don't know that name, you need to write it down, spell it as you would like. Alfred Edersheim, probably the most prolific writers about Christ, the culture in Jesus' day, the temple in Jesus' day. And in one of his books called Sketches of Jewish Social Life, he says this: in the time of Christ, the rabbis taught on this text from Genesis 2. And they taught that every young man had two responsibilities as he grew up. First of all was to find out his occupation so he could create a life. The second responsibility on him given by God was to find a wife. Now listen to this. Because in finding a wife, he found the missing part of himself. He wasn't whole till he found the partner. Why? Because the two become one flesh. And if we understand that the enemy is always going to work to separate humanity from the one they are to be one with, we can't forget that the enemy is going to do everything he can to separate the husband from the wife and the wife from the husband, because they are to be one. Interesting that Paul said the mysterious part of that isn't so much on behalf of the church and Christ. The mysterious part is how we work it out, husband and wife. That's the part that is a mystery. And so we want to, in these next couple of minutes, we want to give you, like I said, three things that have worked for us when we've practiced them. And I know there's many of you that have been married, some of you longer than Rhonda and I have, and there's great experience among all of you. We're not here as experts in anything, but we want to share these three things that were valuable to us, and then if there's opportunity to let any of you ask any questions just about the dynamics of life and relationship and the mixture of that with ministry. It's a tough life. And we live in such a volatile age and a volatile environment. If we're not aware that the enemy's coming after us, we have completely missed what the text, I think, is trying to say. So, here's another thing. We're not going to tell you, we're not going to talk about, well, if you're in ministry as a couple, you better pray together. We're hoping you guys all do that stuff. If not, go sell cars. Would you just do all of us a a favor. You know, go do something else. We're not going to talk about it. You guys have prayer lives and pray for 5 hours in tongues every night. We're not going to tell you that stuff. We're going to talk about the things that I think are a little more practical to application. And so that starts with the story. How many of you remember when Jack Hayford had what he called the School of Pastoral Nurture? Did you go to that, Fred? There were a number of us that went to that. I remember it was exciting when Anna was still alive. You had a whole week with Jack Hayford. Who wouldn't want to do that? In one of the sessions, they actually had Anna there, and any of the group could ask any questions of Anna they wanted. So everybody's asking these questions. So I raised my hands, and I said, here's the question I have. My wife is always telling me I spend too much time in ministry and my mind's everywhere else and I don't spend enough time with her. And I said, what have you done as a couple in life to make sure that when you leave the church stays there? You go home and you have your time together. And she laughed at me and said, I never learned how to do that. I thought, wow, if people there don't know how to do it, I'm on my own with this struggle. So it's a challenge for even the highest that we would see in the work of the kingdom. So anyway, we're going to head that direction and share a few things.
So the three things that we have worked at. The first one, don't sacrifice your children at the altar of ministry. If you go back and you think about Abraham and what he was asked to do, to take his son up and sacrifice him on the altar. He asked Abraham to do that. He hasn't called any of us to do that. He didn't ask any of us to. And the one thing, when we went out to start the church, because when we went into ministry, we were pretty young. The first year of being associate pastors, I was pregnant that whole year, and of course your emotions are all over the place, and then you're thrown into ministry, and that just throws your emotions all into every place. So it was kind of hard. But when we went out to start the church, being associates, it was really different. We had service Tuesday night, we had service Wednesday night, Thursday night. I don't think we did anything. Friday night we had service. Saturday was always some Bible study or going somewhere or doing something. Sunday morning for us, we had to be at church at 8 o'clock in the morning and start with Sunday school.
We had bus ministry first.
You had bus ministry. He went and drove and picked up all the kids for Sunday school. Then we had Sunday school. Then we had main church and choir in between all of that. Then after church, we never went home. We just stayed at the church, ate our dinner with our family, and then we had youth ministry. Then we had choir practice. Then we had Sunday night service. And after Sunday night service, then we usually had some other kind of a singspiration or fellowship time or something. So we didn't get home till late at night.
How many of you relate to that type of a schedule on Sundays?
I mean, it was crazy. Our kids woke up at church and fell asleep at church and woke up in the morning, sometimes in their own bed. So it was pretty a lot. So when we went out to start the church, we decided we weren't going to have all of that because we were captured by the church. They'd always tell us, well, you need to go out and win people for Christ. Well, when did you have time? I mean, we were always at church, so we didn't have time to do that. And so we decided that we'd have Sunday morning service, we'd make Sunday evening, maybe once in a while we'd have a fellowship group with families and do that kind of a thing, and we'd have Wednesday nights for Bible study, and we'd give people the opportunity to actually be a family, to actually do what we've asked them to do, and that's go out into the community and serve.
Yeah, I appreciate what Craig said, and the whole, all this stuff, I agree with that wholly, and about the heritage that we have. I want to remind you, and it's a rich heritage, and we ought to love that heritage, but some of our primary leaders at the beginning had no children. When we first went into ministry, and that's not a crying foul. They didn't. They gave everything they had to the ministry. They had nothing else that they would do. Well, right after Ron and I decided we would go into ministry, before we got the first call, we had a pastor call us to come and meet with them. It was a travel. And so we went there. We had the Sunday evening service. We had dinner afterwards. And they sat down with us and said, we want to invite you guys to come and work with us, because we're kind of at the end You come and work with us. We'll take care of you financially. We just got married, you know, kids, and told us all the things they wanted us to do. And man, we're thinking this is great. And they said, here's what you have to agree to. If you come and work for us, you have to give us your word. You will never have children because they will get in your way. We didn't quite answer it loudly like that, but the oh my goodness was what happened inside. And all the way, all of our travels back home, we just couldn't get, we just said, we can't do that. We can't do that. It was the mentality of some people that that's what you do. That's what you've got to do. It wasn't what we were called to do. So I'm going to let Rhonda continue on. The idea of not putting your kids on the altar of ministry. There's a reason that PKs are notoriously bad. And one has his hand raised, acknowledgement of the truth. Eddie. You know, doesn't the Bible say a child left to themselves brings their mother to shame? Here's why. Because we're so consumed with ministry that we forget ministry. Our first ministry is our family. And if I can't pastor them for whatever years I've got them, then I literally have no business being out there. Now, those were mistakes we made. And again, don't feel a condemnation, because there's got to be some of you whose kids are off. Listen, every kid has a season of stupid. Yeah. That's the honest truth. Every one of them do. Some of them is long. Some of them, it's very short. So this is not a condemnation to you. Please hear that. Because we're faulty people, and we made some pretty egregious mistakes and required things of our kids we should have never. I'm just telling you now, maybe it's your grandkids, or maybe those of you who are young and have kids, let your ministry be appropriate to your first call. Your first call is to pastor your family. So anyway, go ahead, Rhonda, talk some more about some of that stuff.
Well, when we went out there, we determined that we would spend as much time with our kids as possible. And we weren't very far from his mom and dad, so they could have come out and watched our kids. But it ended up that every place we went, we took our kids with us. And it was some of the best productive time that we spent with our kids. Happened to be in a car a lot, but that was okay. And it didn't negate the fact that our kids kind of went off the rails a little bit and had their own little moments of stupid. But that I really wanted to kill him for, but I refrained. But you know what? It just meant that there was foundation there, that there was things that we instilled in them. When I come here and I see all these little kids sitting in church, you know, they think, some of you think it's a disturbance, the ones that are bringing those little kids, but don't ever think that. Because this is important. This is how I was taught. From the time I was born, my mom was a single parent. She didn't have anybody to watch me. She played the organ at church. So she, as a baby, she brought a bassinet. She brought me. She put me on the front row in the bassinet while she played the organ. And that's how I grew up, was in church. That's what I knew. And that was the heritage that I learned. That's the legacy that I have. And doesn't mean that when they get to screaming and bending backwards and out of control that you shouldn't take them out. But for them,
take them out? What did you mean by that?
You can put your own spin on that. I mean, I don't care. I told somebody the other day, it's a good thing I don't teach Sunday school or youth ministry right now, because those kids, I would duct tape them to the wall. I'm afraid. I was just, blah. Yeah, anyway.
Have fun with your kids.
Yeah. Do stuff with your kids.
My lands. The English humorist, I'll think of his name here in a moment, he said, don't take life too seriously. You'll never make it out alive. I know that's against our theology. But man, have fun with your kids. Our kids brought kids to our house all the time because that's where the fun was. I mean, we laughed, we joked, we played. We had a water fight with garden hoses drug into our home one day. And you know, the neighbors are doing. They're wondering what's going on with the crazy religious people. Man, have fun with your kids, please.
And it was a rental house.
Yeah, that was even better. Again, make investments in your kids. And listen, don't make apologies for that to the people who are in your church. I'm telling you. Because if you succumb to that, you'll succumb to other pressure they want to put on you that is not right. And in the end, people will look at what you're doing in your investment with your kids, and they'll appreciate the fact that as their spiritual leader, you're doing the right thing. So have fun, have a blast, go camping, dink around. Anyway, yeah. We'll go to the next one probably. As
our kids, both of them played sports, and we grew up in a time where if sports were on Friday night, because we had church on Friday night, we went to church. We couldn't go to the sports. But we determined that our kids were going to do that. They were going to play sports. Some of the best times that we spent was I rode with Gina at 4:30 every single morning to swimming, slept in the car while she swam her laps, and then took her to school. But the best times were in the car with her, talking with her, you know, just mentoring her without really realizing that's what I'm doing. And Larry with our son when he played football. So there's those opportunities that when they're growing up and when they're in those stages, you know, you have opportunity to pour into them. And it doesn't end there. I come to realize that parenting is forever. And my kids, Mom, what can I do? My son just texted me yesterday about his daughter, and it's like, okay, this is what you need to do. But it's then you get to pour into your grandchildren. God's called you to do that. It's your obligation as much as possible to pour into your grandchildren and to teach them those stories and all those things. You know, we talked about legacy, and we talked about, you know, what those stories from old past behind, and some of the kids will groan and go, oh, here we go again. But my grandmother told me stories of when they would sit down to a meal that they didn't have, and being in the pastorate and that, and they sat down with their girls and didn't have food on the table, would pray for that meal, no more and get done, and somebody would knock on the door with groceries. And I think, wow, that's really something. Never realizing that we would live through the exact same thing and sit down to meals that we didn't have and no more and get done praying and somebody would knock on our door with bags of groceries. So it's important that kids hear those stories from generation to generation. The Bible talks about that. So don't negate telling them, no matter how much they've grown. Just say, just be quiet for 5 minutes and listen to what I'm going to tell you, because someday it may help you, and move on.
Yeah. The second one is this. Take time off. I've never had the desire, and I've heard these wonderful stories, a guy who preaches fervently, turns around and sits down in the chair on the stage and falls over and dies. No thank you. I don't want to do that. Dying with the boots on, I think, is highly overrated. Man, take time away. You need it. Take time, a vacation. You know, we have never in our life saying, hey, why don't we go to Paris this summer? We don't have the money to. I mean, we really don't. You know what we do? We camp. Because it's cheap. Every week you go, you know, when I grew up, my parents, every day or every week my mom went grocery, she bought one more can of something. That's all. Put it on the back porch. And when it was full, we'd go camping. Back then you could go into Yosemite Valley. There was no campsites. There was areas. You paid the fee to get through the gate, and wherever you could squeeze your tent is where you camped. And we camped till we ran out of canned goods and vacation was over. No, seriously, it doesn't take a lot. Just do stuff with your kids. I mean, spend time together. And with your spouse, you better take some time away with them. You have to have time away with them. Don't forget you're one. I kind of worry about couples who don't do that, whether or not they are living the oneness that the scripture says we have. Because if you spend time together, you really do get a chance to walk and talk through things. I mean, my Lord, our relationship has not been heaven. I mean, Rhonda argues with me all of the time. It's just it's the cross some of us must bear.
But, oh, I got a lot I could say.
But I'm telling you, take time away. Go do something. Go anywhere. Drive the car. If you can't, you can't buy gas, ride a bike. Get bikes. Do something. Go on a walk. Go somewhere to get away. Getting away does not have to be expensive. If you have the money to do it, then do it. But even if you don't have the money, go do something. Just hang out.
So do I see a cruise or Hawaii in my future?
If we can ride our bikes there.
Oh my gosh. You're killing me. So bad. So bad.
But anyway,
I can't. I just can't.
I heard a quote years ago that says, true friendship is when the silence between two people is comfortable. And sometimes you're just hanging out. We do that now. We do it a lot now. And so I think that that's...
You know, we live in a day and age now where you have tablets, you have phones, you have TV, you have all this kind of stuff. And it's very easy to take the whole idea of, well, we are together, but he's on his pad and I'm on my phone, or it's the other way around. And we don't sometimes, I mean, we're guilty of it because he has so much going on, and then suddenly I have people calling and doing this and doing that, and it's easy to get caught up in this and think, oh, we've spent time together. No, you have not. You need to take time where even when you go to dinner, you turn that phone off. You set it down. You do something so that you look up at one another and go, oh my gosh, so that's what you look like. Wow. You wore that shirt today? Anyway, but it, just helping you out. But it's true. This can be all-consuming. We think kids get all-consumed. Well, it can happen to us. There you go.
If at all possible, there you go. Take a day off.
From electronics.
Well, take a day off, take a day off. You know, we've been bivocational. I worked in construction. I did asphalt. I did electrical stuff where you're working 80 hours of hard labor and then pastoring 40. I mean, we know those. We've pastored a small church for many years. So we understand those dynamics. But we have tried to, when I wasn't working outside of church, we've always tried to take Monday off. That was just a good day for us. And this is going to sound pretty weird, and I'm sorry that this will be recorded. You know, you get those phone calls, and somebody says, Pastor, can I meet with you today? Thank you. No. No, you can't. I kind of get to the point where, you know, Aunt Susie died. Can you come? No, she's going to be dead tomorrow, too, so we'll meet on Tuesday. I mean, I hate to be so crass, but it's kind of like, no. Some of you will not regain from that thought. But the point is, my biggest ministry is this lady. Hers is me. We struggled because when we started our church, our family all kind of moved close. We were within 7 miles, so my parents were there. I have one sibling. Her mom was close. We were all in the church. And most of you know Jim Garlow. I was at a meeting, actually in Texas, and I asked him this question. I said, with all of our family just being connected, and we spend time together as a family, would people look at that and cry foul? As so many of the families involved in ministry, I never forget what he said. He said, in an era where families are so separated and disintegrated, people will look at you and smile because of what you are fostering and what you are signaling to them about what family can look like. So have time away, take vacations, camp, take a road trip, whatever you want to do. I think that's something we have tried to do. So the third one is?
Financially trust God. When we planted a church, I'll go back. When we first went into ministry, I can remember the Lord saying to us, I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to watch over you, and I'm going to take care of you. And so we went into ministry, and then when we went to plant the church, we wanted to sell our home. We wanted a 30-day escrow so that we could be debt-free and we wouldn't be an encumbrance to the church. And that 30-day escrow turned into 6.5 months of hell. I will just tell you, that's exactly what it was. And it got to the point where every Monday morning he'd have to call our creditors and tell them, I've got $5 I can give you. That's it. And it ruined our credit. At the very end of it, we had a substantial amount of money in equity in this house. And when we got all done, we walked away with $10,000, which was enough just to pay off our creditors. We lost everything. And from then, for quite a while, it was like the enemy just kept snatching things and taking from us. But I always could hear this in my head. You know what? We've been faithful to God. We're going to continue to be faithful to God. And he would vouch for this if I know it's true. I really tried hard not to complain. Maybe I complained in my head. But I drive by places thinking, I'd love to own a home again. I wouldn't want to rent places anymore. But I thought, you know what, if that ever doesn't ever happen, I'm okay with that. And we weren't always, I will admit, we weren't always good with our tithes and our offerings. But we did our best at that time. But when we made the commitment to actually sit down and be completely faithful in that area, there was a turning point in our lives with several things. And kind of a miraculous story. We had decided, there was a lady, and the church was in a shopping center. She owned a business. I helped her with the business. Her husband lost his job. He couldn't find another job. She had to go out and get a job. She says, I don't want to lose my business. I said, I will run your business. And I said, but you don't have to pay me. I will run your business for you. And I did. I ran her business and helped her because I just felt that was the right thing to do. And in that, at the end of that year, they ended up really losing much more than that. But they had us over to their house for dinner. And I can remember driving away and saying to him, oh my gosh, I would love to live in a house like that. Probably about 4 or 5 years later, they were on the brink of losing everything. And my mother happened to run into them. And Jean said, you know what? She says, we're going to lose our house. She said, we're 3 months behind. It's going to go into foreclosure. And my mom said, well, what do you think it would take? She says, well, we're 3 payments behind. And she didn't tell her the amount. So my mom came to me and she said, do you remember Jean? I go, yeah. She says, they're going to lose their house. And I go, oh my gosh, that is so sad. She says, why don't you call them? I said, Mom, we have no money. I said, what am I going to do? Go out in the backyard and I suddenly have a tree out there that has enough money to do this? And I figured it was just, you know, for us, it was a lot of money. And she said, I think you need to call her. So we did. We took that step of faith. We called her. We went to their house. She said, we will do anything to keep our credit clean and to not lose completely what we have. And so we made an agreement with them. His parents loaned us the money to make up the back payments. The mortgage company, we made the payment straight to the mortgage company, and we did that for 2 years. And at the end of that 2 years, we sat down with the lender from the mortgage company, and they transferred everything over into our name, and they walked away with clean credit. They didn't get any money out of it, but they were okay with that. And we walked away with a home that I never thought I would live in.
Yeah, we could not qualify for a loan. We convinced the mortgage company, can you imagine? They had 24 checks that had been registered in the account because we made every payment, every rent payment, which was the mortgage, everyone on time. They qualified us on the fact that we had not missed 1 month's rent. So we bought the house of our dreams with no money. Now, I can't explain that. You know how you get yourself out of a financial hole? Tithe and give. Now see, when I teach on tithing, I don't tiptoe through the tithers. I don't go to see who's giving and who is not. I don't do any of that stuff. And the reason why is when I teach on tithing, I can look everybody in the face without them going, like, he knows I didn't put in for a month. I don't do that. So I don't do that with any of you, so I'm going to look all of you in the eye. Here's the deal. If you're not tithing, Can we understand the important principle taught in the Old Testament? You say, well, the tithing is of the Old Testament. Well, here's a challenge for you. Stop doing worship, because no place in the New Testament does it say to use instruments. So how much else do you want to eradicate? Here's the deal. Again, if you're not tithing, you are robbing God, and there is a curse on your life. I mean, can it get any clearer than that? How do you get out of that? You take the only time in the Bible where God asks you to test him. You know, every place in the Bible it's a sin to test God, except with finances. He says, test me in this. See if I will not open the windows of heaven and pour out a blessing that is more than you can contain. The context of that was the tithe was brought to a storehouse. It mentions that in Malachi. The place where it was all gathered. The visual is this. I'm going to bring you so much that no matter how big your storehouse is, you won't be able to crunch more in and shut the door before it runs back out. That's what God said. And Rhonda's intelligent. I've never claimed to be very smart, but I knew that much. And when you can learn to tithe when you don't have much, you will even more tithe when you have much. And everything Ron and I have, and we live a life that is beyond anything we ever imagined, and blessed in ways we could never conceive. And what God has blessed us with is not a reflection of our remuneration or our financial package. It's just not. And you know how it happened? Because we tested God, and he said, okay. And if you want your church to tithe, you better tithe. If you want your church to flourish, you better give. And we have found that to be a primary practice in our lives. And that's a hard one for everybody to hear. And I'm not looking at anybody to shake their head yes or no, or I'm just kind of glancing to everybody. I want you to all know how sincere we are about that. You have to learn to do that. Or just expect to face financial challenge and hardship your entire life. And I don't shudder. I would never say this in any other context, but when we learned the secret of giving and tithing, we decided we were going to keep doing it, and we increased that. And right now we tithe a little over 20% of all of our income. And that's not a braggadocious thing. That's just saying when you start, who can be trusted with little can be trusted with more. We did that for our church. When we arrived at Celebration Church, first month was November 2001. The first monthly P&L that I got from the bookkeeper showed $50,000 in the red. That was our welcome, Pastor. Seriously. I had one of the leaders say, what are you going to do? I said, I do not have an idea. I have no idea how to respond to this. It was the end of the dot-com collapse. Some of you remember that. And very faithful givers who had lost everything, lost their houses, the church was tanking. I had the cut list. They had already started through it, cutting the employees. So that's what we were faced with. And I determined we got to get the church in another place. And the only way we can do that is we got to start giving. The church has to give, not me. The church has to tithe. And I'll be honest with you, we struggled for a long time. It took us about 6 years to even get the books balanced. Our first year that the books were balanced at that church, 6 years later, we came in $34 in the black. In the whole year. I mean, it was hard. It was tough. But we started giving. The church started giving and started increasing and started increasing. And probably, oh, I don't know, 15 years ago, the church started tithing. We give away 10% of everything that comes to Celebration. We give it away to ministry. We just do. And we increase that to about 11%. I think our highest was 11.4. We've done it every year. Through COVID, the church has flourished so much. We have continued to tithe. Because it's the first tenth. Remember, it's not the leftovers. You know why it's not the leftovers? Because it's hard to give that last 10. But it's easy to get it off the top at the beginning. And at the end of 2021, when we got our P&L, remember I said that we were losing $17,000 a month just in our children's programs? I never told anybody about it. I didn't even tell our leaders about that loss because God said, watch and see what happens. That scared me more than the prospect of going to jail. I mean, I was just scared of what? the end of the year, one of our leaders has been an elder at Celebration for 35 years. The church in every category, savings, working balance, investment, the church has more money than it has had in over 35 years. Through COVID, with that loss, we've gained so much that at the beginning of the year, we started tithing more money out because of the increase. I'm telling you, folks, of all the stuff we've said, I think this one will be most beneficial to you. Learn to tithe. Learn to give offerings. I'll tell you another practical thing. Carry some cash with you. I'm not saying everybody here is rich. We're not. But I always have some bills with me. You know why? Because at any moment, God could say, I want you to bless that person. I'm going, hey, do you take a debit card? No, I carry some cash with me and say, hey, just I want to bless you with this, my friend.
What it comes down to is, do you want your church and you to live under an open heaven?
Yeah.
Because that's what it is. When you learn to tithe and you give, you're going to live under an open heaven. And it is going to shock you what God does. After that house, the Lord began to give back to us all the things that the enemy had taken away. And at one point I said, okay, God, this is okay. I'm okay with this. And he just kept giving, and he still keeps giving. There was a time where we were at a meeting, and I don't remember who the speaker was, but I can remember him talking about giving and so on and so forth, and he said, there are people in this world that are created to make wealth. That's what God has given them the blessing of doing. And he said, but not all of us are that way. He said, but I know people that wanted a raise, and so they began to tithe whatever that raise was that they wanted. Yeah. And that always stuck with me. And so I thought, you know what, Lord, we're just going to start giving more. Because, not because I want more things, not because I want more money, but because I want to give away more. I want to be able to help missionaries. I want to be able to help pastors. I want to be able to help people in my church. So, Lord, you make it possible. I'm going to give more so that you'll give back to me more so I can give more. You can't explain it. There's no logic to it. It's just what God does. And I wouldn't want to live any other way.
I want to share one more story about giving and how God does that. So some of you have been to Livermore. We were blessed with a very, very nice facility. When we arrived, it was in great need of a remodel. And our auditorium is large. And so my son-in-law is a building contractor, so we were going to hire him as the contractor of the... And so he gave us an estimate, talked to all of his subs, and to remodel the auditorium was about $680,000. We're not a rich congregation. We don't have those one or two guys that put in a $100,000 check every night. We just don't. And so we knew what that was going to be, and I took it to the church and said, we've got to raise some money, and we had over $200,000 in commitments made. Some of those were cash that came in that Sunday. And that week, actually over the next couple of weeks, we went to visit Stanley Moodley in South Africa. We went to an area called Orange Farm, which is a volatile area, a lot of violence. We went and did a pastor's conference and met an older pastor, and their building was a shack. It was corrugated tin with no windows. It was like 180 degrees, and this is where they worshiped. I mean, it was just a wreck. And all the way home, God's speaking. So I get home, and I told our leaders, God said we got to give the first $10,000 to them so they can build a new church out of our building fund. So I stood up on a Sunday and explained to them that short story, and I said, so I'm sending a check to that pastor for $10,000 to build a church because we have to invest the first part of it. We've got to invest, and we did. We finished that building project. Significant. I mean, gutting, AC, everything. We finished the entire project for $350,000. And not that we got good prices. We just figured it was because we gave. So it works. But anyway, so that's all. That's all we're going to say.